John chapter 1 this morning. We're going through a series this summer on knowing God. Last week we looked at the only true God. Today we're going to look at Jesus Christ as the God revealing God. We've read through a portion of the text this morning that sets us up for understanding who Jesus is and what Jesus does. I don't know if you've ever been talking to somebody about a person, maybe a place, maybe an event, and it might be something that you know quite well, you're rather familiar with. You enjoy that person, that thing, and all of a sudden that person mentions that they too know that person, or they've experienced that same event, or they've visited that same special place. And suddenly the particulars gain significance as you walk together down paths that only the initiated can know. I was reminded of this the past week as I looked at a video put up by P14 Global Missions. It's the outfit that just bought the campus of Northland Baptist Bible College. And they put out a video of the campus there at Northland. And they're showing some different places, and as they bring up different sites around the campus, you say, oh yeah, there's that place. There's Reflection Lake. You have to get back down to a certain part of the campus. You see where this fits together, and maybe sometimes you're talking to somebody and you're recounting that name, you're recounting that face, you're recounting that event, and it seems as though you struck a chord and you're talking about the same thing. And then all of a sudden you find out, well, maybe that's not the same thing. You come to that point where you realize, chasing down the particulars, you're not in fact talking about the same thing. You're talking about two similar things, but at their core quite different. Jesus basically had the same experience with the people of Israel. Let's take our Bibles. We'll go to chapter 8 in the book of John. We're going to stay in the book of John today, but we're going to be moving throughout the book. Chapter 8, Jesus kind of has the same experience as he's talking to the leaders of Israel. He's talking about God. But in the end, they're finding that they're talking past each other to some degree. John chapter 8, beginning in verse 31, Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. You'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "But we're the offspring of Abraham. We've never been enslaved to anyone. How can you say you'll become free?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." All of a sudden, something happens. Verse 39, they answered him, "Abraham is our father." Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works that Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You are doing the works your father did." They said to him, "We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one Father, even God." Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I came from God, and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It's because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and has nothing to do with the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he's a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God." This is strong language. And to make sure they're not talking past each other, Jesus has to get very specific and says, now listen, you think your father is my father, but if that were true, then you would receive me rather than longing to kill me, rather than trying to get rid of me. You would listen to what I say rather than trying to blow it off, rather than trying to blow it away. And as pressed to the particulars, Jesus had to help them come to the conclusion that if they didn't know Him, that is Jesus, then they didn't know Him, the Father, God. As we come to our text this morning, we find that Jesus Christ is in fact the God-revealing God. In this series on knowing God, we have to be confronted with the fact that knowing God means knowing God as revealed in Jesus. If I don't know God as He's revealed in Jesus, then in fact, I do not know God. That's the conclusion that we have to come to. Jesus was praying in the high priestly prayer. We looked at it last week, verse 3 of chapter 17. This is life eternal, that they know You, the only true God. But the verse doesn't stop there. He continues as he prays, and Jesus Christ, whom You have sent. It's not an either or. It's a both and. As we come to this passage this morning, don't get uptight here. There's 10 truths that Jesus reveals about God. What I'm trying to do with this series throughout the summer is trying to give us not a lot of deep and real meticulous exegesis that we're trying to wrap our heads around. I'm trying to refresh you with just some basic things. Things you already know, things that you already love, things that you may not look at for a while. Things just to remind ourselves. And so as we come to this, there's more truths that Jesus reveals about God than 10. Okay? We're just going to confine our study to the book of John. And there's more than 10 in the book of John. So there's no way that we can cover everything that Jesus reveals about the Father. But hopefully we'll talk just very quickly this morning about 10 things that will help our hearts to be rekindled as we look into the face of Jesus. That face that reveals to us the face of the Father. So as we look this morning, I'd like us to see back in chapter 1, Jesus reveals the message of God. Go back to chapter 1, because several of these points come from this prologue that John sets out for us. In the beginning was the Word. Jesus is entitled the Word. We're told in verse 14 that the Word became flesh. We're told how this Word operates. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him. That is the Word. The Word is the authoritative expression of the Father's will. Jesus is the authoritative expression of the Father's will. It's also the active expression of the Father's will. Back in Genesis chapter 1, as God said, let there be, all of a sudden, boom, there was. When God works, God speaks. And when God speaks, God works. And Jesus, when He comes on the scene, is called the Word who expresses the will of the Father, the Word who reveals the will of the Father, the Word who accomplishes and activates the will of the Father. Jesus is the Word. We started out the service this morning with Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Long ago, in many times, in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, God has spoken to us by a Son. He's worded through Jesus, the Word, the one who He's appointed heir of all things, the one through whom He created the world. As you look at how Jesus reveals the message of God, over and over again, He's expressing throughout His earthly ministry
that what he says doesn't originate with him. Go up to chapter 3. Chapter 3, verses 31 through 34. John is writing commentary on the life, the ministry of Jesus. It says, "He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth belongs to the earth and speaks in an earthly way. He who comes from heaven is above all. He bears witness to what he has seen and heard. Yet no one receives his testimony. Whoever receives his testimony sets his seal to this, that God is true. For he whom God sent utters the words of God." So either you accept Jesus, and in accepting Jesus, you accept God's words, or you reject Jesus. And in rejecting Jesus, you reject, in fact, what God has to say to you. Chapter 7, verses 14 through 16. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up to the temple and began teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, "How is it that this man has learning when he's never studied?" So Jesus answered them, "My teaching is not mine, but it's his who sent me." These aren't my words. The things that I'm telling you, they don't belong to me. They belong to my Father. He told me, in fact, what to say. Chapter 8, verse 26. Jesus says, "I have much to say about you and much to judge. He who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him." They didn't understand that he'd been speaking to them about the Father. So Jesus said to them, "When you have lifted up the Son of Man, you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing of my own authority. But I speak just as the Father taught me to speak." You don't have to go there, but chapter 12, 49. "What I say, therefore, I say as the Father has told me." Chapter 14, verse 24. "Whoever does not love me does not keep my words, but the word that you hear is not mine. It's the Father's who sent me." Jesus reveals the message of the Father. So when Jesus says, now listen, in Matthew chapter 5, later in the chapter, it talks about, it's the Sermon on the Mount. "You have heard it said, thou shalt not commit murder. I'm telling you as the Word of God, as the mouthpiece of the Father on high." He's not just talking about those times when you take out your knife and butcher your brother. He's also talking about those times when you conceal and hold on to and harbor hatred in your heart for your brother, when you write him out of your life. That's what he's talking about. I'm not just talking about the fact of crawling into bed with another woman. I'm talking about the fact that you lust after her in your heart. This is what God meant in the first place, and I can tell you that this is what God meant because I stand as the Word of God, the mouthpiece of God. My message is from God. So, be perfect like your Father in heaven is perfect. Wow. I mean, those are some kind of words. The whole point is, you can't. That's why Jesus has to come. But Jesus is the message of the Father. You ever get those things where you try to wonder, what does all of this mean? And then you go back to the Gospels and you hear it from the mouth of Jesus. And you say, oh, that's what it means. Jesus gives us the message of the Father. Jesus, secondly, reveals the life of God. Go back to that prologue. Jesus is the Word. He's the message. He's the mouthpiece of God. It says in verse 4, "In him was life." In Jesus was life. Just after the middle of the book, chapter 9 is about the middle of the book, chapter 10, he comes and Jesus is discussing who he is. The fact that his words are not received by several of the people there, especially the authorities there in Jerusalem. And so Jesus says, listen, I want you to understand who I am. Think about a sheepfold. Understand that I'm the shepherd, and I have sheep. And as I call to my sheep, those will respond to me who belong to me. They're my sheep. I'm the good shepherd. You don't hear me because you don't belong to me. You can't belong to me if you don't listen to me. But all who do belong to me will listen to me. And as Jesus is explaining what it means to be this good shepherd, he says in chapter 10, verse 10, I have come that they might have life and that they might have it abundantly. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. You ever felt like life is constricting you? Life is sucking the very breath out of you? Whether it's relationships, whether it's time constraints, whether it's misunderstandings at work, at home, budgetary crises, maybe it's just the changes in life as you say goodbye to another child as they go off to college, or you welcome another child into the family through marriage. Life just changes all the time. Jesus says, my purpose in coming is so that you can have life that looks like life. Why is this necessary? Because all the way back in the story, back in Genesis chapter 2, when God is setting up the rules of the garden, he says, man, this is my rule. Do not eat this fruit, because in the day that you eat of it, you will surely have the life sucked out of you. You will die. When you raise your own hand as an authority against my authority, you can't help but running head to head against me, and you will lose, in fact. And life as you know it in its abundance will cease. Jesus says, all you've known up to this point is the life-draining, life-sucking reality of rebellious creation. That's all you know as you seek to make a way for yourself. Jesus says, I have come to give you life. Life that is abundant. That's why he can say, come unto me all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Learn of me. I'm meek, I'm lowly in spirit. You will find rest for your souls. Take my yoke. It is easy. My burden is light. Talks of being in a yoke, taking up a yoke. A yoke usually has two places in it. One for one animal, one for the other animal. Jesus says, take my yoke. You stick your head through one side it, and I stick mine through the other. We're going to pull this together. And I make your burden light. Jesus says, I came so that they can have life. But the only way they can have this life is as I lay down my life. 1 John chapter 1 has a prologue as well, written by the same author toward the end of his life. Listen how he talks about Jesus. That which was from the beginning, which we've heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we've looked upon, touched with our hands, concerning the word of life. This life was made manifest. We've seen it. We testify to it. And we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we've seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you can have fellowship with us. Indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. What does life look like? Life looks like knowing God. Life looks like fellowship, restored with God and with man. Oh, and we just have a foretaste of that glory just now. But Jesus says, I have come to restore what you have been created for. Life. Reflecting the image of God. Having fellowship with God. Having fellowship with man. Having harmony with one another. That's why the church, he says, this is how all men will know you're my disciples, that you have love one for another. So Paul says, be of the same mind. Work together. Let there be a harmony. Let there not be discord and fractures and fragmentation. All these things suck life. Don't let there be envy and jealousy. Don't let there be murders and dissensions. I've come to restore life for you. Jesus is that for us. Number three, Jesus reveals the light of God. John chapter 1, verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. Let's keep reading. This light shines in the darkness. The darkness is not, ESV has overcome it. I believe King James, the darkness has not comprehended it. The better word there is comprehend, because there's kind of a dual meaning of the term. The term means to seize or to grasp. And it can mean either to discern, you seize it and you understand it, or it can mean to seize it and to snuff it out. So the darkness did neither. The darkness, those who were blind could not see the light. Neither could they overcome the light. Neither could they put out the light. They couldn't douse it when they tried to snuff out the light. In John chapter 8, verse 12, Jesus stands up. He says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. This is the invitation that he gives. Accept me, receive me, believe me, and I will give you light. I will make you to see things that you never saw before. I will shine light on your life in ways you never thought imaginable. I will shine my light into the darkest recesses of your life, the corners that you find time to hide. The things that you don't want the light revealed. I'll shine my light there. And it says, as the light is being shown upon these things, that people who have this light shown onto them don't really like it, because Jesus reveals all the ugliness, all the skeletons in our closet. But those who are willing to have that light shine into their life also see that Jesus is not just light, but he's also love. And Jesus, as he shines his light in the dark recesses of our hearts and uncovers all that we'd like to leave buried, has this invitation. It says, you know what? I've paid for that. I've taken care of it. I still love you. Come to me. There's nothing in the darkness of your heart that I don't want to bring to light. Because until you allow me to bring it to light, I can't deal with it. But I'm ready to, and I want to. Don't hide it from me. The darkness has not comprehended this light. There's a story at the center of the book of John. It's chapter 9. It's the story of the man born blind. And the question is from the disciples, who sinned, this man or his parents? Jesus says, no, you're missing the point. I want to use this man as a picture, as a story of what it means to have the light come. All of you by nature are blind. Okay, you start out that way. You're just born that way. You can't see right. But I've come into this world so that I can take those scales off those eyes. I've come into the world to make the blind see. Isaiah had told that that's what the Messiah would do. And so Jesus touches the blind man. He restores his sight and he can see fully. They ask him, who was this man that healed your sight? He says, you know what? I don't know. Well, is this man from God? I believe he's from God. You say he's not, but I believe he is. Well, what do you know? He says, I'll tell you the one thing I know. Here's the only thing I know. Once I was blind, but now I can see. That's all I know. I don't know who it was. I don't know how he did it. This is what I know. Once I was blind, now I see. Because Jesus is the light. Jesus meets up with him a little bit later. And he says, would you believe in the Son of Man? And he says, who is he? So I can. Jesus says, it's me. And that man who had trained his ears over the course of a lifetime to discern between the distinctions and nuances and voices like nobody else who has their sight can ever do, recognizes the voice and says, you are my God. You're the one I want to follow for the rest of my life. He sees the light. They run into some proud, arrogant Jews, Pharisees, there in the temple. And they see that Jesus has restored the sight to the blind man. And they ask this question. So Jesus, are we also blind? Because Jesus had just said, for this purpose have I come, so that those who are blind can see, and those who think they see can be blinded. So the Pharisees ask, Are we also blind? Up in verse 40 of chapter 9, Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. If you think you see without the light, you're kidding yourself. But when the light shines on you, and you bow and you bend to the light the way the light shines in your life, then you can see. Jesus is the light. Jesus shines light on our lives, and he enables us to see that God isn't looking into our lives to exclude us from life, from peace, from joy. He's looking to shine his light on our lives so that he can remove from us that which separates us from life, so he can deal with it, so he can pull it out very strategically in our lives and deal with those things. Jesus reveals the light of God. We're back in the prologue, John chapter 1. We move a little bit forward. Verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. This idea of glory is going to permeate this book. It goes along very significantly with light. Jesus is the light of God. Jesus is the light of the world because Jesus is the glory of the Father. And over again throughout this book, the glory of God is shining through. Chapter 3, verse 19. Chapter 3, verse 19. This is the judgment. The light has come into the world. People love darkness rather than light because their works are evil. The idea of glory is the idea of this sparkling, brilliant splendor that shines upon creation. It shines into creation. This is the condemnation. God has shined forth. And people hold on to their darkness. Chapter 7, verse 18. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, Jesus says. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true. In him there's no falsehood. Jesus says there's this glory factor. I'm not coming to you in my own authority. I'm not coming to you with my own message. I'm not coming to you with my own light per se. Though I am the light, I'm reflecting the light of my Father. I bring to you the light of my Father. I want to shine into your life. As I'm coming, I don't have an agenda for me. I'm seeking the glory of the one who sent me. Later on, as the book closes, as it comes down to the crucifixion, it says that there were certain ones that wanted to believe in Jesus, but they didn't dare do it because they were seeking the glory that comes from men rather than the glory that comes from God. Here's the thing. Jesus brings glory to the Father. And we're going to see how that works in just a minute. But Jesus is the light of the world because Jesus is the glory of the Father. Let's look at what that means. Back in chapter 1:14, the Word became flesh, dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as the only Son from the Father, filled with grace and truth. At this point, he kind of explains and unpacks what this glory means. The glory of the Father means being filled with grace and truth. As you chase down this phrase, we find it here in a Greek expression. But it follows on the Hebrew truth that is transmitted to us in the Old Testament. These are the two focal points of God's name as they're given to us in Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. Abounding in steadfast love and emet. The word means both truth and faithfulness. Jesus brings glory to the Father because Jesus reveals the name by which God chose to be known, the name that he revealed to us. I am the one who is filled with steadfast love and truth. And he reveals it at a time when his chosen people had flagrantly disobeyed. They'd made that graven image that we looked at last week. They'd thrown their fist in God's face. As God had said, make no image, have no other gods, and said, these are your gods, O Israel. And Moses comes down from the mount and he takes the Ten Commandments and he throws them on the ground. And everybody's wondering, now what? God says, now I'll tell you what. This gives me a perfect opportunity to let you know what kind of God I am. Okay? This is the deal. You broke it. But I can't. I love you. And that's the kind of God I am. When you turn your back against me, I still don't turn my back against you. You come down in this passage, verse 17. The law was given through Moses. You must be perfect. I can't. That's the whole point. But grace and truth came through Jesus. Our God isn't only a God of law. Our God is also a God of mercy. God is just and God is merciful. But God is just. He can't just get rid of my sins as though they didn't happen, because they did. He can't pretend my rebelliousnesses don't exist, because they do. And in Jesus Christ, we get to see not only the justice side of God, as God wreaks His wrath on His chosen one, and His face is marred beyond recognition. We also get to see in the face of that bloodied Christ, the mercy, the tender mercies of a loving God. This is what it means. His glory is revealed in this name that He brings. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 7, God says to His people, don't take up my name in a flippant manner. And I'm not just talking about swearing or cussing. I'm talking about saying that you belong to me and then living like you belong to the devil. Okay? Don't take my name and call yourself by my name and live in a way that exalts you, in a way that looks like the world. Don't do that. Jesus says in chapter 5, verse 43 of the book of John, I've come in my Father's name. Okay? You don't receive me. If somebody else were to come in their own name, you'd receive them. I'm coming to reveal to you my Father's name. In chapter 12, we have this scene where Jesus comes into town 1 week before His crucifixion. We know it as Palm Sunday, and everybody's throwing down the palms and they're taking off their coats and throwing it in the way, because blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. This name of God is a big deal in the book of John. In chapter 17, verse 6, as Jesus is praying, He reminds His Father, I have manifested to them your name. In fact, at the end of this prayer, He says, I've made known to them your name, and I will continue to make known to them your name. There's more of your name that these people need to see, because I haven't yet died in their place for their sin. And as Jesus is hanging on the cross and breathes His last, He says, now, Father, it is finished. I have declared your name. You are, in fact, filled with steadfast love, with grace, with faithfulness to a people who's turned their back to you. What an amazing God. Jesus, as the God-revealing God, is the revealer of God's name. We see, sixthly, that Jesus reveals the purpose of God. Back to chapter 1. Jesus reveals the purpose of God in verse 29. Next day, John the Baptist sees Jesus coming toward him and says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. God's purpose wasn't to destroy the world, it was to take away the sin by which we merited destruction. I love John 3:16. You're familiar with it. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. But the next verse is hugely important as well. For God sent not His Son into the world to condemn the world. And He could have done that. But so that the world through Him might be saved. That's God's purpose. And we only ever see that purpose through Jesus. He shines in bold relief the purpose of the Father to redeem us. To give life to the world, chapter 6, verse 33 says. God's purpose is to chase you down with His eternal love. That's His purpose. To deal with your sin, not pretend it doesn't exist, but to deal with it. And to remove it, to take it away, to lift it out of the way. Number 7, Jesus reveals the nature of God. In chapter 1, verse 34, John the Baptist again says, I have seen and I have borne witness that this is the Son of God. The idea son of something has the idea of having the nature of something. So in the Old Testament, it talks about the sons of Eli. Talks about them being the sons of Belial. Sons of the devil. Okay. Calls them sons of the devil because they lived like the devil. They had the nature of the devil, and that's how they lived. Rehoboam in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 21, is said to be a son of 41 years. That is, he had the characteristics, he had the nature of being 41 years old. That's so this idea of being the son of something has the idea of bearing its nature. Jesus has the very nature of God. And as we go through the book of John, we see that Jesus takes great pains to help them to understand that I and the Father are one, he says in John chapter 10. You can't get around this. That's why in this book in particular, we see in John chapter 1 verse 14, he's called the only begotten of the Father. He's the monogenes. He's the only one who has the same genesis from God, the same existence, the same essence, the same. He's made of the same stuff. In verse 18 in chapter 1, he's called the only begotten God. And if you have a King James there, it's built on a different translation text, family. It says the only begotten Son, who's in the bosom of the Father, reveals Him. Some of the other texts, some of the better texts, have the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father. The only begotten God? What is that? The one and only. The only one who has the essence as God, who is Himself God and is with God, is the one who reveals God. And this monogenes, again, is found in chapter 3. God gave His only begotten Son. Chapter 18, He's called the only begotten Son of God. And kind of stacks on these titles so that we understand Jesus is, in fact, the same thing as God Himself. So Jesus says in chapter 8, verse 19, if you knew Me, you'd know My Father. You believe in God, believe also in Me. No one comes to the Father except through Me. Chapter 14, verses 7 and 9. If you'd know Me, you would have known My Father. From now on, you know Him, you've seen Him, because whoever's seen Me has seen the Father. Do you want to know God, Jesus says? Do you want to know God? Then look at Me. Because you can't know Him if you don't know Me. Number 8, Jesus reveals the work of God. Jesus reveals the work of God. Whether it's the religious in John chapter 3, Nicodemus, who comes to Him by night, he says, don't you understand that unless you're born again, you can never see the kingdom of God? Or if it's a woman of Samaria by the well, whom the Jews wouldn't even interact with, a woman who's had 5 husbands in the past, and is living with one who's not her husband in the present. Whether it's the religious of John chapter 3 or the irreligious of John chapter 4, Jesus comes to work the work of the Father, that is, to restore creation to Himself. John chapter 12, there's some Greeks who want to come and see Jesus. And Jesus says, not right now. Don't hinder me from what I'm about to do, because after I'm lifted up, I will draw all men to me. He says, guys, we've got to work the works of the Father while it's still day. He goes into the temple and he heals a man from his withered hand, a palsied man. He heals him on the Sabbath. He says, guys, my Father's been working. And He's working today, and I'm just joining Him in His work. And He's working a work to bring creation back to Himself. Number 9, Jesus reveals the heart of God. I love this. You come to John chapter 11. You're familiar with verse 33. And Jesus wept. Okay, shortest verse. You hope you get that one when you have a list of verses you have to memorize. John chapter 11. Look at verse 33, though. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who'd come with her also weeping, He was deeply moved in His spirit. And just so you get it, and He was greatly troubled. Verse 38, and Jesus, deeply moved again. Jesus, as He looks at death, and He looks at the consequences of sin, and He sees these people that He loves and loves dearly, and He sees what it happens in their life as a result of the sin that He's come to take care of, and He sees the hurt, He sees the pain, He enters into it with them. What an amazing God that He can enter into our pain with us. And then from that, He calls us to rejoice with those who rejoice, to weep with those who weep. You see it in other stories. You see it in the life of the rich young ruler. As Jesus tells him, okay, you've done everything so far. Here's the one thing you need to do yet. Go and sell everything you have and give it to the poor. And he goes away because he had great possessions. And what does the text say? And he loved him. He loved him. Jesus saw that he went away sad, and he had a compassion on this guy. He said, you know what? He doesn't say, what an idiot, told you so. Tough luck for that dude. Jesus had compassion on him. You find out, the man with the withered hand, Mark chapter 3. There was times when Jesus reveals the heart of the Father, and it's a rather stern heart. Jesus tells the man, comes to him with a paralyzed hand in the temple one day. He says, Jesus, won't you help me? Jesus says, stick your hand out. He looks around, and everybody's watching, calculated, kind of rubbing their beards and saying, wonder what's going to happen. It says, and he looked on them with anger. He was seething. How dare they be more concerned with their snooty selves than one who has a genuine need? Oh, cut him to the quick. On a different occasion, Jesus is watching. He's parked outside the temple, and he's watching as different ones come and give their tithes, their offerings. All of a sudden, two little tinny clinks fall, and a little woman hobbles away, a little widow. And Jesus calls everybody, all his disciples around, says, listen, hey, guys, listen. There were no trumpets just now, but there were in heaven. I want to draw your attention to something, because this just got the heart of my Father, and it got my heart as well. This woman gave more than anybody. She hardly gave everything, but it was anything she had. This gets my attention. Jesus reveals the heart of God, and it's so different from our own. Finally, I want you to go to John chapter 12. John chapter 12. Not everybody was getting what Jesus was selling. Verse 36, middle of the verse, when Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. Though he'd done so many signs before them, they still didn't believe in him. So that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed what he's heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Back in Isaiah, just before the 53rd chapter, where we're familiar with the suffering servant, It says in Isaiah 52, verse 10, "The Lord has bared his holy arm before the nations, the eyes of all nations, and the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God." When Jesus Christ comes, it's as though God himself rolled up his sleeve and said, "I've got something to show you, okay? You can't do this, but I can." And he gets himself to work. And he puts Jesus on stage, front and center. Romans chapter 1, verse 4 says that Jesus was declared to be the Son of God in power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by his resurrection from the dead. And God bared his holy arm and dealt with what you and I could never deal with, given a million lives to do so. We could never build a bridge to God of perfection. But God, doing what could never be done through the law, removed his wrath through Jesus, so that God himself could be both just and the justifier of those who place their trust in Jesus Christ. I wonder sometimes, do you ever feel, as I have felt, distant from God? The encouragement this summer is that knowing God means knowing God as revealed in Jesus. Okay? If we're not actively knowing Jesus, there's no way that we can possibly be genuinely knowing God. But here's the flip side of the truth. If we are actively knowing Jesus, we can in fact genuinely know our God. I don't know if you've taken time this summer to read through one of the Gospels. I encourage you to do that. Maybe you have a little more time. Maybe you don't have more time in the summer. Maybe your downtime is in the winter. But whenever you take time, take some time to look again in the face of Jesus. Get to know your Father by getting to look at His Son. Look again to know God through the person and work of Jesus Christ. Because when you do, the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace.